Sometimes it's a metaphor for puberty. In honor of Spider-Man Homecoming, what film deserves a sequel that's de-aged to the teenage years?
I'm Matt Patches. I'm going to go with My Dinner with Andre, or maybe like the Before trilogy. Anything that is mostly communication, but now they're Snapchatting, or they're snapping, or it's cool, and they're talking on the phone.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I don't think it should exist, but if Back to the Future 4 existed, a prequel that's simultaneously about a sequel doc that exists on all time periods would be interesting.
I think that's Rick and Morty.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm just going to go with the Teen Godfather. Why not? they had to start somewhere, right?
I believe this would air on MTV and that Dave would do the animation for it.
Yeah, Teen Godfather. that technically falls under my purview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. It's episode number 172. Wow. For Friday, July 7th. And on this day in 2011, so long ago, the final Harry Potter film, The Deathly Hallows Part 2, premiered in London.
Time for a reboot.
We already have a new series with Fantastic Beasts. It's awful. What do you want?
Fantastic Beasts was totally pleasant.
Absolutely awful.
Why is it awful?
That's a whole other segment. But
it's totally pleasant.
As someone who always thought that the Harry Potter movies had a half leg up on the books and really were working with some magic pun, very lame and easy pun, very much intended. I thought that the Fantastic Beasts was genuinely disastrous. And they made the very ill-timed and lack of foresight decision to cast Johnny Depp as the entire franchise's big bad. So
you
good
can't
luck with that.
Blame the don't
good
don't
luck with that.
Curse. Don't
have fun
in Potter terms.
The
don't
good
curse
news
this movie for having
only get
Johnny Depp
because the first one was
so bad, final beat. Who could have known?
We'll see.
I mean, anyone who probably met him could have known. But who? David Yates is such a quiet, simple man. He just loves thespians and what they do. He probably saw a lot of potential in Johnny Depp. That's not his fault. Fantastic Beasts.
Whatever happened to Rupert Grint? Is he still alive?
He's in a Crackle television show version of Snatch.
Hmm.
He has a career.
That sounds about right.
As long as people are watching Crackle. Anyway, this is the part of the podcast where we usually do reviews, but we don't have any. Why do we not have any reviews?
Ridiculous.
What have we done wrong? Have we run out of?
I guess we've alienated everybody with our tribalism.
That's a callback to the last episode. Well, we need to figure this out right now because I can give away two Blu-ray copies of the movie Free Fire, and I want to give them away. But I'm trying to figure out. I want to do it as a giveaway, as an iTunes review giveaway. But how do I do it?
Okay, how about in their review, they leave us 5 stars.
Well, I don't want to ask them for 5 stars. That's begging.
Oh, I mean, okay. Did they leave a review with an indeterminate amount of stars?
That seems fair.
And say, they don't have to imply that gun violence is horrible, but my favorite gun movie is blankety blank.
Oh man, that's dark. We're in too dark a times to have that. These are the very simple rules that you have. We need you to leave an iTunes review if you want to win a copy of Free Fire. All you have to do is leave a normal review, critique the show, tell us what you like, tell us what you don't like, but you have to use the words free and you have to use the word fire at some point in your review. They don't have to be back to back.
I like that better.
You have to stuff them in there somewhere, and then we'll know that you left this because of this giveaway, and then we'll have to get in contact with you either via like Twitter or Facebook or something. So you need to be more than your iTunes, avatar name or whatever. So make sure you have another way of contacting us when we want to reach out to you. But other than that, that's the way we're going to do it. And then we'll announce the winners next week on the podcast.
Although, trigger warning, if you don't know what Free Fire is and you don't like gun violence, maybe don't enter the contest.
Trigger warning?
Hey-o!
Hey!
We're professionals. Free Fire? I don't think we should talk about that part on this podcast, but I did. I really like Free Fire.
I like Free Fire, too.
Good experiment in the shootout genre.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
I liked it. Win a copy of Free Fire, leave us a review, and now we'll move on to the actual part of the podcast.
Kill Jay-Z. They'll never love you, you'll never be enough. Let's just keep it real, Jay-Z. Fuck Jay-Z. I mean, you shot your own brother. How could we know if we can trust Jay-Z? And you know better, nigga, I know you do. But you gotta do better, boy, you owe it the blue. You had no father, you had the armor.
A ghost story.
You're saying it like you say ghost ship.
Ghost ship? More like a pile of ghost ship. Jimmy! That was for the late, great Gene Shalit. Don't tell me he's not dead, because he's dead in my heart. A ghost story by David Lowery. A film by David Lowery, who you may know as the writer-director behind the likes of Vain the Body Saints, and more recently pivoted towards studio terrain with Peach Dragon.
Did we ever talk about Peach Dragon on this podcast?
We must like have. I thought Peach Dragon was wonderful.
Yeah, I feel like we talked about
I thought it was that. Wonderful, beautiful movie.
Yeah, and I think a lot of what David Lowery owes the success of Peach Dragon to is that he and his producing partner, Toby Hall Brooks, have a really great way of not really adjusting their methodology based on the size of the project that they're doing. I mean, Disney allowed them to operate in a way that they were accustomed to, because I think for Disney, they were making a very low budgeted film. I mean, for them, it was obviously many times larger than anything they'd ever made, but compared to what the rest of what Disney was doing, it was like a rounding error. So it worked out very well for all parties. And they are going to be very capable of easily slipping back and forth in between studio stuff and more independent-minded fare if they so choose. But the ghost story, which they shot immediately after wrapping Peach Dragon, is very, very much in the indie vein.
He started writing it during like post-production on Peach Dragon, right? Kind of sprouting out of Peach Dragon.
Yeah, they shot it certainly not in secret. And if you follow David on Instagram, you could see that he was up to something, that he was shooting something. All of the details were few and far between, but it was not a heavily publicized thing. It felt during its production, at least, that it would be a little bit of a come down wank, you know, the sort of thing that directors do on the sly, one for them and one for just my friends, really, not even for a small audience. It felt like the kind of thing that would be a more of a playful exercise than anything else. And so imagine my surprise when I saw it just before Sundance and was really knocked sideways and thought that it was the most fulfilling and complete and it's a very substantive piece of work for something that was shot on the fly and for not very much money and in a very limited way on just a handful of locations, primarily in one house. It's a really sort of massive piece of work, and I'll tell you a little bit about it. It's a story, you may know it by this point, as the movie where Casey Affleck walks around underneath a bedsheet for the vast majority of the running time, and that's as good a way of thinking of it as any. It is the very hushed, very somber, very, a wonderstruck sort of film about a couple living in a one-floor home in Texas that they sort of have an argument in a very elliptical, hushed sort of way that David Lowery likes to frame these things. And then in the first 5 minutes of the movie, Casey Affleck's character, who speaks primarily in mumbles, gets into a fatal car accident, leaving Rooney Mara, his partner, alone in their house, the house that Casey Affleck did not want to leave, but that Rooney Mara's character did. And sitting there on the slab in the morgue, Casey Affleck's unnamed character suddenly comes back to life, or back to death. He wakes up with the sheet that was over his body sort of becoming his little enclosure, his little costume for all eternity. He shuffles back home and he begins to haunt their house out of sight, silently, watching Rooney Mara consume a pie in one very long take. A whole pie.
An entire pie. And it goes on and on.
It's the entire sequence is two shots, but she really goes to town on that pie in the second one. I saw the film for the second time last night, the first time I'd seen it since January, and I was blown away all over again at how long that shot is. And to hear it from Rooney and David, it was the first pie that she'd ever eaten. It was a vegan, sugar-free pie, so not particularly appetizing.
I can't believe this story. I've read it several times. No offense to Rooney Mara, but I just don't believe it.
I don't know if I had a pie, like a genuine pie, until my 20s. I don't think it's impossible.
You can buy pies at the grocery store. They're just sitting there.
I know, but I didn't. I don't know. Maybe it's a New England thing. I'm not sure. But
well, David's family didn't even own a football team or anything.
I know. We were really growing up poor. We didn't own two football teams, let alone one. So we had a tough time affording pies like the Maras did until the Giants won the Super Bowl, and then it was a very different story. This is a film that has a lot more in common with Terrence Malick's recent movies, particularly The Tree of Life, and that sort of something between The Tree of Life and the last 30 minutes of 2001 A Space Odyssey, that sort of cosmic flow to it, a lot more than a traditional narrative. But there's something very gentle about the storytelling, that it does not feel oppressive or exclusive. It is, once you roll with the pie shot and sort of get on the movie's rhythm, it is very welcoming, and it becomes... yes, a ghost story, but more than that, a really sort of soft-spoken but profoundly beautiful meditation on time, on loss, on the spaces that we inhabit, and the transience and ephemerality with which we inhabit them. It is not a movie that oversteps its bounds and tries to tell you in explicit terms how to interpret it, but is really fulfilling, perhaps because of that, surprising in a lot of ways. I really hate to reveal here.
Although I don't think it's as like ethereal and connecting the disconnected, if you will. Like, you know, talking about Terrence Malick, that seems like a mischaracterization. You know, I take flack on this podcast for once calling Tree of Life a poem, which I deserve to take flack for.
A what?
But I will say that
a
I think that
a poem,
a poem. What did I say? Poem.
A poem.
I do think that there's something like Victorian about this movie.
It opens with a Virginia Woolf quote, you know, which is.
I forgot about that. The movements of it, the like stanzas of this, it's more tangible than a Terrence Malick movie. It's not as flowing. It's pretty strict in the way it goes from scene to scene.
Yes.
And it's plotting a temporal arc, and not to give too much away, but like it really. There's structure to this movie, and it's on firm ground.
Yes, there's a score by Daniel Hart, who has done the score for. It's a beautiful score.
Awesome.
It plays a much larger role than I remembered. And one of the songs from Daniel Hart's band plays a prominent role in the film as well, called "I Get Overwhelmed." But the film, it's not a Terrence Malick movie. I'm not saying that it is. I'm just saying that it's a basis of comparison.
I can imagine people conjuring this movie in their minds, and it's not what anyone thinks. I think that's the most surprising thing.
But yeah, I mean, it is certainly its own beast, and I think that it's one of those concepts that sort of works because it shouldn't on paper, and even describing it sounds sort of silly, but the movie recognizes that it is sort of, it has some chuckles at the expense of its premise.
Very funny parts.
Yeah, it allows you to laugh at it. It wants you to. There is a certain preciousness to it, but I think that when you're grappling with themes as infinite as these, really looking back and sitting back in wonder and sort of embracing the wonder of it all and not being overly cynical or interfering with the things that we know and don't know, I think it all works very, very well for the tone of the movie.
Let me ask you a question to kind of wrap up here. It's something I think about a lot when we watch all sorts of different kinds of movies. And I think about it during a ghost story, and it's something I think about during watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy. How do you think these movies achieve scope faithfully and tangibly I think about A Ghost Story, it's a sweeping movie that spans many generations, and it feels like a lifetime lived. And it's something that I think Lowry, just through character and through visuals, he's able to capture scope. And I think about the blockbusters we see today, and they don't ever feel big, even when they're trying to go big, 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 big. And I wonder, and this is for both of you, like, how does a movie capture scope, even in a smaller setting where most of this movie takes place in a single house? But it feels like, as I said, lifetime lived. Is there something, do you think, that Lowry does specifically in the movie that makes large?
I think I was thinking about this. Time certainly plays a role, but it's an incredibly resourceful film. It really exists in the space beyond the frame, even though there are moments in the movie where it isn't afraid to sort of stare into the abyss. But I was thinking about this in terms of It Comes at Night, which I finally got around to seeing on July 4th, and is another movie that is released by the same company, but it also occupies sort of the same scale, in that it takes place all within a house, and it is really, it infers so much about the world outside of those walls, but that comes down to what we believe from what the characters express to us. It comes down to sound design. It comes down to the how palpable the aesthetic of the film is. I think that's something that the craft of A Ghost Story can't really be extricated from the effect of the film as a whole. I mean, there's something so rich about this world they create, from the sound, from Daniel Hart's music to Andrew Draws Palermo's cinematography, and just the fact that Casey Affleck's character, who again spends so much of this movie underneath the sheet, becomes, while very much his own character and moving with his own sort of sense of his gait and his posture, it's very idiosyncratic. It still allows you to project so much onto it. It is sort of the cloth becomes a screen for whatever thoughts you might have, and that is really about as big as the world can be. One of the things about that movie that is so interesting, and one of the points it's trying to make, is just how vast this one tract of land can be when you stretch it out on the horizontal axis, when you really look at it, not just in your daily
the cosmic
routine,
calendar.
Exactly. And so, the place, it will get you to reflect on the scope of the room and the plot of land that you occupy now as you're listening to this. And so, very interesting.
A Ghost Story. It's out now.
Go see it. I want to.
Oh God, I'm clean out of air in my lungs. It's all gone. Played it so nonchalant. It's time we dance with the truth.
Dave, what did you do this holiday weekend?
This holiday weekend, I was in Nashville, Tennessee, specifically in the Gaylord Opryland Hotel. Have either of you had the pleasure of being there before?
No, I've only been to Knoxville. I've never been to Nashville, which was way southern.
I would go to Nashville only because they have a surprisingly strong hockey team.
Didn't you have a panic attack like a mile outside of the New York State area when you went to Katie's wedding? You could never last in Nashville. You would your head would be spinning.
I had a panic attack. I had the time of my life. We stopped at the Sonic Burger as the sun was going down. It was delightful.
I heard once you hit New Jersey that you were just like,
I was there
in
yeah.
disbelief.
Was I not?
No one wants to be in New Jersey.
That's true. But was I not in great spirits? Was I not so excited?
You were. Yeah. You were thrilled by the Sonic. I remember that very clearly. But anyway, the Gaylord Opryland Hotel is basically like a city unto itself. It's multiple buildings, and then they have three like atriums that are like the size of city parks, that are like domed over with glass. And then, part of one of those is adjacent to what's actually a convention center. It's not the hotel. The first annual Con of Thrones, a Game of Thrones convention, was there. In multiple rooms, and then we also had some rooms, like, in one of the atriums, they have an island that has, like, a little mini city in it, and the second level has, like, meeting rooms. It's a crazy hotel. The important thing is this convention. It's the first time it was put on, but it's put on by the people who put on, like, the LeakyCon for Harry Potter. They're called Mischief Management, so they've had some experience running conventions before, and that allowed it to sort of run really smoothly. Usually, like, first-time conventions, you have a couple of rooms and a couple of panels and then some vendors. This one we were Con of Thrones managed to book enough rooms with enough panels that there was consistently multiple choices about things, what to do. Some of the stars came, none of them that were actually still on the show because we're weeks away and they're actually on a press tour, which pushes their appearance fees up into the unaffordable amount right before a new season comes on. But that being said, Kate Dickey, who played Liza Aaron, was there. The guy who played Cyril Farrell, whose name I can't remember anymore, Miltos. Well, it's not that I can't remember it. It's that I don't know how to pronounce the last name.
I guess this Miltos is a spoiler is that he name. Doesn't come back in this new season, basically.
Well, that was the joke on the Ghosts of Westeros panel hosted by friend of the podcast, Joanna Robinson, and maybe listener to the podcast, Dave Chen. One-time listener to the podcast. Probably not anymore. But I was there with my Star Wars Spoilers crew, and we got to do some panels. Basically all our panels were themed around the great debates. So rather than having a panel where we all sit down and tell you about the show, since we're not really qualified to do that, I took my show expertise and my compatriots took their book knowledge and show expertise, and we would host a debate around a certain topic and get the audience to suggest, different, answers. Like our first one was the worst job in Westeros. And so for about 40 minutes, we took the polls of worst job and then by applause narrowed it down to the Mountain Squire is the worst job in Westeros, which it's very show specific. I assume you guys watch Game of Thrones.
I do, but I have no idea what you're talking about.
Anyway, it's some of them were more specific than others. For our most upsetting deaths panel, we actually got interrupted by the actor who played young Hodor and the actress who played Shireen, and she ended up swinging that panel in her favor because it's hard to look her in the eye and say that her getting burned to death on screen wasn't the most upsetting thing to happen in Game of Thrones. Mm. So stuff like that happened. We had some karaoke. We had some good cosplay. All in all, it was a pretty fun time, and it was well enough attended that it looks like Con of Thrones 2018... will definitely be happening.
Did they screen all seven episodes of the new season?
Yeah, you've seen everything.
Well, actually, unfortunately, no. We were so my podcast, Storm of Spoilers, obviously in the name, got an email the week before. It was like, hey, also, let's not be spoiling anything at our convention if need be. So we had to change the parameters of our show and actually push our spoilers into the podcast later on. But that being said, next year is going to be fun because it's probably going to be an off year between seasons of Game of Thrones.
Wait, really?
That's going to be...
2018 will be a complete down year with no Thrones?
So here's what it looks like based on the most common knowledge, or the most current knowledge, is that they're debating whether or not taking a year off to do production entirely, and each one of the remaining six episodes in whatever that final season is could be 90 minutes
long.
That
is insane. That's stupid. Just end it. End it already.
Well, they are. They're going to end it with six little mini movies.
That's crazy.
In 2019. So if there is an off year in 2018, Con of Thrones 2018 is going to be the place to be. I imagine it was well attended enough that next year we'll be able to pull all the actual stars and HBO sponsorship and whatnot. And Storm of Spoilers will be back there.
I mean,
you guys should come.
Here's the thing. So Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con, has been under fire this past week because a lot of comic vendors haven't been able to attend because it's too expensive to go. It's out of control, movie, TV, pop culture fest. Do you worry that something like Con of Thrones could just go the corporate route, could get too big? Is what was fun about this weekend a certain size of convention that most people don't realize because they either have never gone to a convention or they've attended Comic-Con or seen people attend Comic-Con, which is just an absolute frenzy.
I think that the fact that it's centered around Game of Thrones will keep it right about the size that it needs to be for however long it wants to run. Mm. There was always conventions for Star Trek, even when Star Trek wasn't on. There were Twin Peaks conventions before the revival.
But now Star Trek's in Vegas. Every year. Star Trek is huge.
And now Star Trek's in Vegas. But I think that that's, you could support that sort of growth and still have a lot for people to do. This one, the greatest thing about it was getting to like actually talk to people one-on-one that were as obsessed as you were, and that's the level the convention's at. And at least when I attended San Diego Comic-Con, it was hanging out with those same people that I had the best time. So I think you're going to find that kind of con anywhere, but a con on the grow is, I think, going to have cooler vendors, the sort of thing where it's like the cast members are just hanging around the hotel afterwards. All that sort of stuff happens in the early years, and it's happening now.
So is Con of Thrones on the calendar for next year? Or
If you go to their Twitter account, Con of Thrones, you can find a link to sign up for email updates for Con 2018, if that's your thing. Or you get in on the early block.
When is Leftovers Con?
I don't know, but the thing is only
it's on another
90%
planet,
of the people who buy tickets into that actually get it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the series is about, right? I didn't watch The Leftovers.
Let's talk about the Spider-Man movie, the new one.
Let's.
Not the old one.
The
or
new,
the older,
new one.
Older one. Yeah, the new one.
And I, for one, think that there aren't enough Spider-Man movies. Well, or enough Spider-Man for that matter.
I'm glad you said that, David, because next year we're supposed to get an animated Spider-Man
movie. Oh, good.
It's different. It does not take
no,
place
in the my one
Spider-Man
condition,
movie. It's a new Spider-Man movie.
Good. My one condition is going to be that it needs to tell the origin story again and be cast a completely different Spider-Man.
Now, don't be that cynical, because they didn't tell the origin story in this one.
I know. They showed some mercy on us, and thank God for that.
They made a pithy joke about it. Wait, what movie are we talking about? We're talking about Spider-Man Homecoming.
Hey!
The long-awaited
my
movie
most anticipated
Dave.
Movie of the year!
Well, Dave, can you explain why this is a long time coming for you and perhaps why it fulfilled on those expectations and how it did so in a very brief
sure.
way?
How wide do we want the focus to be here? Do we include hacking by North Korea, or do we just
Holy
get
shit,
it over
does
with
it go
and talk
back
about the movie?
That far?
Yes, it does.
I'm interested in that dot connection. But
I was about to say that I'm not particularly interested, but I will say that, you know, the financial calculus behind some of the Spider-Man related decisions has been really, really wonky. I mean, this is sort of the Amazing Spider-Man years were sort of emblematic of everything that's wrong with Hollywood, especially the second one, which is a movie that made grossed more than $700 million and barely, if at all, eked out a profit. So clearly there was something wrong. Something needed to be done. Those movies had no real incentive to continue. And I think that,
what do you mean you they know, didn't have an incentive to continue? We want to know what happened to Peter's
of
father.
Uh-huh.
We wanted to see the Sinister
Six.
I wanted to see.
We would have eventually gotten a third Amazing Spider-Man,
I
but I think what we were really saved from
movie.
Was what we were really saved from was a Sinister Six Venom spinoff earlier than the one we're going
it's
to get.
Unimaginable at this point. Like, how can you? What would that movie have been? That's a can of worms. I don't want to open that, but
I think it's going to be very similar to the one we get.
I have spent a lot of the last 24 hours sussing this out, doing the math, and I think that it's entirely reasonable to include, maybe not start with, but to include The Amazing Spider-Man 2 in the conversation of the worst movies ever made.
F you. The Amazing Spider-Man 2 is definitely flawed, but it is... I'll say this. The splash pages of Amazing Spider-Man 2 are worthy. I had a hell of a time in that movie. It's so ludicrous. From Dane DeHaan yelling, like, blood, to the Electro shooting, like, slow-mo freeze frame, to Hans Zimmer's just ecclesiastic score. It's just so crazy. The movie is bonkers, and there's so much. It reminds me of the latest Transformers movie. There's just so much money being thrown at the screen at every single second. You can't imagine that they wouldn't have gone into that movie with a solid script. And yet here we are, outsider art there on the screen. I had a blast watching that in theaters. I can't imagine watching it again, but it is not an awful movie. An awful movie is like the Fantastic Four movie that was botched and thrown on screen. A bad movie is, you know, we've seen awful movies.
Hey guys, my internet cut out for the last like 90 seconds. Did anyone say anything?
Yeah, me. I was just ranting.
I
just told you why Amazing Spider-Man
was. I heard every godforsaken word of it.
Fuck you.
I was trying to do you a favor.
Maybe God damn you.
To cut it out of the episode.
I'm here for Amazing Spider-Man 2.
No, that movie has got awful trash.
The first one is bad.
Andrew Garfield, they have chemistry.
Oscar-winning actress.
You get 30 minutes of uninterrupted rant time because my dinner is here. Goodbye. 30 seconds.
Is he really leaving?
I don't know. Do you want to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming? I feel like somebody should.
We should wait.
But if David's not coming back.
I think he's coming back.
The saving Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Are we still talking about the Amazing Spider-Man 2?
only to bring you back into Spider-Man Homecoming.
Dave, yes, I'm marked improvement.
Dave should now launch into his Spider-Man Homecoming thoughts.
Spider-Man Homecoming is the first solo Spider-Man movie in the new incarnation of Spider-Man that we were introduced to in Captain America: Civil War. It's a shared Spider-Man character between Marvel Studios and Sony Pictures. Sony owns all the other characters besides the characters that have previously appeared in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And they are going to reap all the profits of this very fun Spider-Man movie where he takes on the Vulture, who is a blue-collar villain kind of put out of work by Tony Stark's damage control, which takes all the damaged cities that the Avengers blow up and cleans them up and gets to keep all the scrap, which they're supposed to put in Safety Shield custody. But now the Vulture and his team of villains are stealing little bits of alien technology and pieces of Ultron bots and are making weapons that they're selling on the black market. And Spider-Man, 2 months after interfering in the civil war between the Avengers, is itching to have some real superheroing to do with his new fancy Stark suit and gets tangled up in all of this, much to the chagrin of Mr. Tony Stark, who, despite the advertising for this film, is not in it as much as I was expecting. One thing that I thought was really interesting is, like, two of the money shots in the trailer, Spider-Man and Iron Man, like, swinging together around Queens, and the Vulture landing in, like, at the atrium of a hotel, are just straight up not in the movie. Like, rendered just for the advertising. So I think there's still a lot of surprises for Spider-Man Homecoming to have. I think especially much it portrays of Peter Parker's high school life.
I saw a lot of people complaining about that. That fabricated shot. Is that so bad? Like, who cares what trailers are made up of for these giant blockbusters? Wouldn't we rather have them kind of boiled down to big money shot moments that sell the concept, that sell the idea of the movie so that the movie is a total surprise?
Yeah,
I much prefer that to like chopping up into bits. It's like a poster, right? A poster doesn't have to sell the absolute frame of a movie.
And the poster for Spider-Man Homecoming certainly did not.
No. It saved a Pollock version of the movie.
Yeah, but I do think that, you know, there is a not-so-fine line between false advertising and selling people, as Patches was saying, on the gist of a movie. And I think within reason, if you're going to go through the expense of rendering shots, special effects heavy shots that happen to not make it into the theatrical cut of the movie, and audiences make the mistake to think about those shots and look for those particular images rather than being sold on the idea that they represent, who cares? I mean, if you... You know, when you see this all the time in much with trailers that have footage that is entirely in the movie, but are very misleading. I mean, it's like something that A24 did with the trailer for It Comes at Night, or at least some people accuse them of doing. I don't necessarily see that argument, but
what did they do?
They just like made it seem like it was a monster movie,
right?
Where that was the accusation. I thought that I don't know. Maybe it was only
even,
because
even Trey Schultz, the director of that movie, thinks that they did that in the trailer. So
yeah, but I mean, maybe it's because I knew that Trey Schultz directed that. I was like, there's no way there's a monster in this movie.
Yeah.
There's a part of the Spider-Man Homecoming trailer where he's fighting the Vulture on a plane, and there's like a key element that is left out of the trailer footage that shows up in the movie and ends up making that sequence like really visually interesting in a way that the trailer sort of makes it drab.
Do you mean stupid? Really visually stupid? That stupid fucking scene? That's so stupid.
Yeah, that is a bad scene.
And it's
I wish we weren't talking about that at first because I really, really enjoy Spider-Man Homecoming. But
there's a lot to like about this movie. Most of what works about this movie is when it leans away from the Marvel verse and leans into more of it, becomes more John Hughes than Stan Lee. Regrettably, the balance is not right. The movie is at its best in the first 30 minutes when it really sticks to Peter Parker's high school life, his friends, the girl he likes, etc. The further it gets away from that, and certainly
it barely
gets
away from that. That's what's so fun.
No, it gets away from that for the vast majority of the movie. Oh. And when it does, and certainly whenever it veers towards action, which John Watts cannot handle to save his life, even though these action movies, the Marvel movies, are shot really by committee. At this point,
that's the thing. You can't even blame John Watts for making the Hughesian moments work. Don't blame John Watts for the
if you don't like me at my Hughesian best, you don't get me at my Stanley worst or whatever. But the
Feige. Someone blame Kevin Feige.
Fine. Fuck you, Kevin Feige. You ruined
Thank
it.
You.
I don't know. I don't care.
You did.
The action in this movie is the worst that it's been in any of the Marvel movies ever. I think it stings more than usual, because the action is seldom very good in these movies, because the human stuff works so well. And so my big argument for this movie was that it points the way forward to, I think, what the future of the Marvel movies could be, which is genre, which is like really leaning away. Because the Marvel movies have sort of become their own genre, and they all follow the same beats, and they're more or less the same scale. But this movie is so interesting and so much fun, and the characters are so alive, except for Mary Jane. Not Mary Jane. Is she Mary Jane? Zendaya? Whatever. She's in the movie for 3 seconds. She's great in all 3 seconds. Where does she go? I don't know. Make a Spider-Man story that is a high school movie where the main character happens to be a superhero. Make a Batman movie that is a hard-boiled detective story.
But none of these movies can do that from start to finish, and that's like,
right, but they
thinking to think that it can drift into genre when
it's not
it's responsible criticism.
I'm saying that is what would make for a good movie.
That's still wishful thinking, that you think that this movie can from start to finish be a high school movie.
I don't know
for
why
some
they
reason
can't.
And I don't understand why personally they have to like blow up at the end every time. There has to be this like incomprehensible action scene where two CG characters fight. Happens at the end of Spider-Man, good movie. There's something about whatever the intelligence tells studios that there has to be some like big inflammatory conflict at the end. It's bizarre because they aren't very exciting ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think if they sold this, I think the thinking is that the movies have to be pitched as these massive spectacles in order to draw in massive audiences and really play across the world. And I think when you're talking about the international box office and the audiences in China and so on, who fuel so much of the industry these days, there is definitely more of an international language to visual action. The high school movie genre, especially as it's been conceived in the United States in the John Hughes vein and so on, does not travel nearly as well. And I understand that. However, it doesn't need to travel nearly as well if you're making a $40 or $50 or $60 million movie. This is a lot smaller than the other Marvel movies, and it feels that way even when it blows up at the action at the end. It feels more like a phase one scale. But I do think that the way of keeping these movies interesting after the Infinity Wars blow over is to lean hard into genre and make them more representative of the characters rather than all cleaving down to this
one
thing.
Let's back way up, because we're piling on like an afterthought in this movie. Like, the final beats are bad, but so much of this movie is hilarious.
Second and third acts.
And intimate. Dave, this movie gets a lot right for you, right? Come on.
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, it gets the ending just fine for me. I mean, considering that you can't get through a Marvel movie with like some sort of weird action sequence, it gets it over with fairly quickly in comparison.
It's pretty short.
Which David's comparison is like crappy action. I'm happy that Spider-Man, you know, doesn't go all out and become like a full warrior Spider-Man in the first one. At least a lot of what worked for me is when Spider-Man's in the suit, but not necessarily in battle, which is a surprising amount of this movie in comparison to other Spider-Man movies, where you really get to see him trying to help or hang out or thinking about whether or not he wants to use his powers to impress a girl. Those things, I think, really work. Things about him having to, you know, hide things in his school, I think, really work. The one scene he really gets with Michael Keaton, I think, works. Everything else just sort of, seems like caulking in between it. And what I was so pleased about is that as a Spider-Man comic book reader, they basically did nothing that I was expecting from the comic book. So it's not like I saw my Spider-Man on screen, but what I saw was one that like was built around this world that Tony Stark exists in and ends up being the most enjoyable part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
My favorite scene.
So it's like
was
a new take on Spider-Man.
I was gonna say my favorite scene was probably the one where the giant humanoid lizard crawled out of the toilet at the high school bathroom and attacked Peter's butt.
To be fair, that is the first Amazing Spider-Man, and that is a bad movie. I'm not defending that movie. I'm defending Electro.
God, the crazy bar bald was head. So low for this, and kudos to Marvel that they cleared it.
There are no crossbreeds in this movie. Unless you consider Robert Downey.
It's going to be interesting, I think, to see how both the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the burgeoning Sony Spider-Man universe or whatever the hell it's going to be, both rebound out of this movie because it's so tonally lighter than both of them are. I presume where the Venom and Silver and Black movies are going to go on the Sony side, but it's definitely lighter than what Infinity War is going to be about.
Wait,
on the Marvel Cinematic side.
Dave, you mentioned something interesting that I wanted to explore a little bit deeper earlier when you were talking about who owns these characters. So, Marvel owns Spider-Man. I'm asking. This is me asking. Marvel owns Spider-Man, but Sony owns all the other characters. So that means Sony owns the Vulture, which means that can the Vulture even be so much as referenced in future Avengers movies? Like, where is the line drawn? With how fine-tooth a comb are the lawyers going over these scripts in the future?
So Spider-Man has 5 movies that he's being shared for, and those are all Marvel Studios movies. While that deal is happening, Marvel has to okay the use of Spider-Man in Sony Spider-Man movies. Sony has to okay the use of any of the characters that originate in Spider-Man Homecoming. If they're ever referenced in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that has to be like a deal to make things better in between the universes. All the characters that are referenced here, we get 2 Shockers that show up in the movie. We get a Scorpion. We get Donald Glover as like the Prowler. None of those necessarily come to full costume villain status, but if they did, it could be in a Sony movie. It doesn't necessarily have to be in Homecoming Part 2. Those movies, those characters belong to Sony. Zendaya's Michelle or whatever belongs to Sony. Ned Leeds and the Vulture, those are all Sony things.
Now, if they want to spin off Tyne Daly into her own movie, will Tyne Daly get her own movie, or will Tyne Daly be part of the MCU? I just want to say Tyne Daly over and over and over again. And I'm just so happy that Tyne Daly is in this movie. As the head of Damage Control, I should say.
Hmm? Yeah, Damage Control is interesting because they might have ceded Damage Control to Sony a little bit because it's
unclear where
that sits. That's the company Tony Stark starts to clean things up. It was going to be an ABC sitcom that would take place in the MCU, but that got canceled when Spider-Man Homecoming started developing Damage Control into their property. I don't know if it because it originated there that now Sony got damage control, or if it's one of the shared properties over this 5 years that everybody's just agreeing to share.
Here are two things I really liked about this movie. One, more than any other Marvel movie, it really ran with the idea that the events of the previous Avengers movies, in particular the attack on New York, were part of the greater mythology in the world here. I mean, to the point where they are literally teaching the events of Age of Ultron in Peter Parker's high school class, which I thought was a very funny joke. There are a lot of other jokes in that vein that are...
Oh, you'd
very...
love the Marvel Netflix shows, David. You should watch all of them.
Nope.
They make so many fun references.
Or when they have Captain America and the Hannibal.
That's very funny. But it's one thing.
Gym teacher's like, I guess he's a war criminal now.
Simply referencing one of these events with a wink is a far cry from doing it with a sense of humor, with like real wit and cleverness. And I think that there is something about, you know, the 9/11 parallels to the Battle of New York in these movies have always been very, very on the nose, but I think there's something about looking at this younger generation of characters and them growing up in this world where all these events are history as much as anything that happened 300 or 400 years ago, because they don't remember vividly living through them. It really helped me sort of orient myself to this new generation of characters, to this how, you know, where Spider-Man was in his life in this movie, how young he really was, how naive, how innocent, etc. I thought that was a nice touch. The other thing I liked was that, while I think the villain doesn't really get the comeuppance he deserves, I don't think it's the third act he deserves, I should say. Comeuppance, sure. One of the downsides of ever getting invested in one of the villains of these movies is, you know, they're just going to get, you know, they're going to resolve in a blast of CG colors and so on. One of the things they do to really keep this movie grounded in scale, keep it smaller than Guardians of the Galaxy and more about just making sure that Queens is safe and whatnot, is, I mean, essentially Michael Keaton's villain is like an Islanders fan. Like, that's his character. He's like a New Yorker, you know? He's like, hey, I'm the foreman for this group. I'm a New Yorker. As someone who's lived in New York his entire life, I should have a better New York accent on tap. I like that he was just a guy, and he was a resourceful, enterprising, capitalistic guy. He probably voted for Trump. Probably is an Islanders fan. That's really who he is, and even when he goes off the rails, I think that's something that I've always liked about the Spider-Man villain. I mean, my knowledge of this is much shallower than Dave's, but the villains in the Spider-Man movies, much more so than the villains in a number of these other superhero franchises, are all good people gone bad. They're all sort of fatally flawed, but at least at some level have some of their humanity. I think Vulture is a little quicker to give in to his worst instincts than Doc Ock was, or even Norman Osborn, but I do like that he is not Loki, he is not Thanos, he is not whatever the fuck, Ronan the Destroyer or whatever. He is a guy who has good parts of his life and his personality and is struggling with the same sort of dynamic between power and responsibility and being corrupted by his opportunities and so on that Peter is, and so they make for interesting foils, and that's something that a lot of these other movies don't really run with, and it's something that I think is done reasonably well here and gets payoff in at least one strong scene.
Well, I think that's why the movie works so well. Every character is like that for me. I mean, even Tom Holland as Peter Parker, he's a schmo kid, he already has these powers when we meet him, but he's still trying to navigate, like, getting home on time, doing his homework. He's kind of fading out from the school environment because he's excelling too much, but all of his friends want him to be there for their experiences, and all of his friends seem very down to earth, and like, they're not stereotypes of high school kids. They're real high school kids, and they're going to do academic decathlon, and they care about the school dance, and when one of his friends finds out that he's Spider-Man, it's the coolest thing ever, and that night they were going to make a Lego Death Star, but instead they're going to go out and fight crime, maybe. And I just thought all of those touches and all of that time we get to spend with them just kind kind of hanging out and living in New York and being in Queens or whatever. It's really pretty powerful stuff. I just love hanging out with those guys and those girls.
Yeah, I'm much more looking forward to Homecoming 2 than the Infinity Wars.
Oh, yeah. The Infinity Wars has trouble written all over it.
I just don't know what scale I'm supposed to be on, because it seems like Peter Parker was introduced in a way that, you know, managed to keep him on the Queen scale, and then this movie manages to keep him on the Queen scale. What happens when they send him into space? Jesus
Christ.
But
this is why I'm surprised, David, that you like all the MCU references, and that obviously the history is interesting, that this is a real world, and real world events have happened, and they impact, and they ripple. But there's just so many things stuffed into this movie that are references or kind of nodding, you know.
But they're funny.
The presence of Tony Stark. Some of them are funny. But like the technology and like getting him into the Avengers and this whole shtick about, you know, what his life could be if he's one of the heroes. I didn't really buy that as much as just trying to be a hero in the first place and trying to grapple with.
I don't think it was necessarily executed to perfection, but the device that they use to sort of allow us to see the battle for Berlin or of Berlin or whatever the shit nerds call it from Captain America World Police is very, very clever. And I think that a lot of the in-jokes work because, like any other kind of humor, they're done with intelligence and wit and... They are funny, and they have the added benefit of helping flesh out this world. I think that when they are lazy nods to fans, they can be obnoxious and they eat up time that could better be spent on other things. But when you have people like Martin Starr and Hannibal Buress finessing these jokes and really giving... Like, the thing that's funny about all the Hannibal Buress stuff is that he is as, you know, bedraggled and exhausted... teachers, gym teacher, detention guru, whatever the hell his job title is, as you would find in real life and that we all remember having for ourselves. And it's that combination between the heightened elements of the MCU and just the work, you know, the run-of-the-mill stuff of being in a high school, even a fancy magnet high school in New York City, that I think makes it funny. It's the collision between those two forces. And it's very, very, very well done and well scripted, while it's able to be its own thing before it has to follow the IKEA-like instructions of how to assemble a Marvel movie. Mm.
John Favreau,
or Donald Glover,
is in this movie.
Or Tony Revolori.
Donald Glover is in this movie.
Or Bokeem Woodbine.
Or
Marissa Tomei.
All good.
There's just so many people.
Marissa Tomei, now that I've seen young Aunt May, I don't want to go back to old Aunt May.
Really? I just learned today that old Aunt May from the Sam Raimi movies is Jennifer L's mom. I didn't know that. And, you know, I was watching Spider-Man 2 again yesterday, and, like, she's so good in that. And I think you're insane, because young Aunt May is so underwritten in this movie, like all the other female characters. And she has, like, three lines, and it's totally useless.
I hope they
use her more in the sequel, but...
No, I totally agree. I mean, Aunt May in the Raimi trilogy really works because of that comic dynamic that he's going for. He's going for something totally comic booky, so he should have like the perfect elderly old woman as his aunt, and everything is pitch perfect in that. And this is reality, and Marissa Tomei totally works as the single mom surrogate, but where is she in this movie? Why is there not more Aunt May sass? Why doesn't she get a scene with Robert Downey Jr. where she's in her face? Or I don't know. Or like Michael Keaton. She should be slapping people or something. She's great.
I hope that's where they go with Homecoming 2. There's indications we might. And I say more Marissa Tomei.
Marissa Tomei. Spider-Man Tomei.
Yeah.
Anyway. Spider-Man
Homecoming 2 May.
Homecoming is in theaters now.
Go see it multiple times like me. I got my head, but my head is unraveling. Can't keep control, can't keep track of. That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. Let's tell the people where you can find more of us on the internet.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com, and I am on Twitter at Mr. Patches, and you can listen to these episodes at fightinginthewarroom.com. You can also comment, share them with friends. Clearly, more people need to be listening because we need more iTunes reviews, too. So go to iTunes and then go to fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find me on IndieWire. You can find all of us together on the website started by our next president, Mark Zuckerberg. Barf. yeah, we'll see. What are we talking about? What do you do? Facebook. Right. I was going to say, what was the name of the first site that Mark Zuckerberg started? A campus.
Campus rate, camp rate. Oh man, that's gonna bug me.
That's something gross. Anyway, Facebook. Fighting at the War Room.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find the show on Twitter at FITWR. You can answer this week's lightning round question, which was, in honor of Spider-Man Homecoming, what film deserves a sequel that's DH the teenage years? We're going to really do our best to have Katie Rich back next week. But until then, go see Spider-Man Homecoming and Ghost Story. Those are your homework assignments.
Face match. Course match.
Great.